Welcome back to Behind the Splinters, a limited series interview podcast about the making of sci-fi's 12 Monkeys. This is Beep. In just a moment, you'll hear CC and I speaking with showrunner Terry Metalis, the production designer on 12 Monkeys, John Mott, and the set decorator, Justin Craig, about designing everything from a time machine to the Wild West. Enjoy.
So welcome back to co-creator and showrunner Terry Metalis. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
And today, as newbies, we have John Mott, the production designer.
Hi there. Great to be here.
And Justin Craig, the set decorator. Welcome to you.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
So we were actually talking a little bit before the podcast, and Terry, you said you had a production design story that has now made its way into your life. So tell us all about it.
Well, it was funny because I've been recently emailing John and Justin because I moved into a new house. And in Los Angeles, and it has it's one of the few houses, I think, in LA that has an actual like basement. And so I was going to turn it into a screening room. So I've been blowing these guys up. I don't know how many years later now we are, 3-4 years later. And I'm like, hey, so I've got the wallpaper from the Emerson Hotel. What's the complimentary paint color? Or what's the wall sconces? What do we do for that? And so these guys who are obviously moved on to bigger and cooler jobs are still getting emails from me. And so I just finished it the other day, and it's like what I was telling them I did is I went into this chest of old props from the show and had like newspaper articles on Jennifer Goins framed, and when they blew up Hitler, that article framed, and little bits and pieces, and like hung it so it's all, you know, the old 1950s photo of Cole and Cassie.
That's great.
So like when you walk down into this thing, there's such a mood. You feel like you're walking into the past, but it's all because of these gentlemen right here.
That's amazing. And fabulous that you've done that. I'd love to see it one day.
I will absolutely. Next time you're in Los Angeles and this plague goes away.
This plague.
Justin is also on a Star Trek as well. Right.
Yeah. Congratulations, Justin. That's so great.
Thanks, John. Yeah, I'm on the new series, Strange New Worlds. So
I know all about it. I hear about it daily.
Yeah,
it's very cool. I was saying just earlier that I thought it was so great that you know, Terry and all these other people are still so interested in the show. And I also, when I went back and looked at your questions, was just reminded about how broad the world was, how complicated it was, how much stuff we had done, the fascinating stories and connections between all the characters and the times. And obviously, that was super clever of the guys, and it was a real great challenge. And it was a wonderful opportunity to work on that show. I absolutely had the best time.
Everyone says that, which is so cool. But literally everyone we talk to says that the best time, and they look back on it, you know, from other jobs. And even though, like Terry said, you might consider something you've gone into, you know, better or higher profile, but people just look back on it with such nostalgia and excitement.
Yeah, you know, it's one thing to jump onto another show. Like I just came off of The Expanse, and you know, and it's science fiction. It just has its trajectory. But what I loved about 12 Monkeys was the opportunity to do so many different things.
Yeah.
And so you know, that was totally key. Like, yeah. So to do period, to do labs, you know, science fiction, to do, battle war stuff. It's just such a breadth of sets that we were able to do. That's what I loved about the show.
You gotta love time travel, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's so funny. I feel like people so often talk about world building when it comes to fiction, and you all were actually building many different worlds from week to week, as you just described. Can you, just for the layman listening, John, can you explain to us, when we see, for example, production design, what departments you're overseeing? And maybe just give us a little bit of an overview. You get a script from Terry. For those of us that don't work in television, what are these departments and sort of what happens next from the word on the page?
Sure. Well, the production design is really kind of in charge of the look and the feel of the show. From the very beginning, it's like how dark or light is it in terms of tone, and also, you know, color schemes and things like that, and obviously the specific sets. So it's very much trying to get in sync with the creator, if it's a movie or, you know, or it's a TV show. It all starts at a similar place. And then so you end up like, where are we? We are in this particular show. We're currently a present time, which has a plague, and we're also in the future. And then we're in all these different other past areas. And how do we visualize those, and what kind of tone would they be? Are they super dark? Are they light and cheerful? Obviously not in this particular case. So it's a tone thing. And then it's the specifics of that particular script. So if that's talks about going to the past, we'll discuss, you know, what is it that we need to do and what do we need to build? What could we find locally that might look old? So there's the building of the sets that we go to every week. The permanent sets is what they're called. So in this particular show, it would be the time machine, big room, and then all the corridors and areas that are off that, the whole sort of Splinter Raritan thing that ended up getting bigger and bigger as the seasons went on. And then there's the sets, so the locations that happen in that particular episode. And then how would we find them? What do we want them to look like? How can we make them unique to the show? That kind of thing.
Justin, could you describe what the set decorator, how they work within that and within the production, what they're responsible for?
So our job is to manifest John's vision and his direction. So you know we'll get a script and Jonathan will read it and I'll read it, and you know John will have his ideas and you know I will have my ideas, and you know we bring them together and you know we come up with a plan, and then I'm kind of let loose to you know go out and source the elements, build the elements, you know, upholster, wallpaper, you know, find all the details and the sprinkles that go on to all the sets. So John will have, you know, he'll have a very specific idea about what he wants things to look like. And we'll manifest that from the ground up, from like flooring to furnishings, to lighting, to, you know, to wall textures, technology, you know, all of that. You know, it can be a challenge on a television schedule, but you know, I think John and I pulled off some really great looks on the show.
I think you did a fantastic job, Justin. And one thing about Justin's job is, you know, the taste and the connection and you know, he has to be able to talk to different people into his life.
Yeah, to that. And so I'll work with John and the director specifically. You know, Terry and I cross paths a lot, but Terry was like so busy. So we'd get, you know, we'd sort of connect during our production meetings and our meetings on various levels. And then we work with all the other departments. We work with wardrobe, the paint department, the construction department. So I guess you could say, you know, I'm John's right hand, but also, you know, I try to bring as much of my my creativity to the show as possible.
Right. And that bleeds in across other departments too, because sometimes it bleeds next to props. Like I remember a couple things, for instance, like if it was attached to the core, like the cells that like Cole removes in the second season, that's something you build. He removes it from the set. So it becomes part of the set. So you design that, even though it's like kind of a prop, right?
Sure.
Like, how does that work?
Sure. So it's one of my most favorite things, because I kind of have a high threshold for how I think science fiction should look. So, we have our time machine and the core and stuff. And so, you know, we inherited the beast, and, you know, we tried to bring as much texture to it without changing its original look too much. So like, you know, given case where we have, you know, we have Tex or Cole working on it, or, you know, people interfacing with the, you know, with the technology, I jump right in there and I say, okay, well, this should look like, you know, and I'll riff on stuff like, you know, like on the Nostromo and Alien, or if I go like something like Battlestar Galactica, or, you know, and I'll say, okay, this is how I feel it should look. And so I work with my builders. I created a great build department who are with me today, actually. We've been together for years now. So, you know, any of that technology that interfaces, you know, we design it, we build it. And then we take real world, sort of real world passes on it, right? So I'll look at the CERN collider, which is kind of what we're riffing on for the time machine. you know, I'll look at like nuclear power plants and I'll look at real world technologies and I'll say, okay, well, let's build that and build, bring all these different elements together and we'll sort of manifest a design.
So we wanted to start, and let me ask really quickly, John, were you with the show beginning in season one?
Yes, I did all the seasons.
Okay. All right. So we wanted to start at the beginning with the Raritan facility. And, you know, not only is sort of the look and the mood of that set the stakes in terms of the post-apocalypse, but you also you're building a time machine. So we'd love to hear sort of about that process and how you all designed and constructed that set.
Sure. So the pilot was done in Detroit. Yeah. And they did have a time machine, which we incorporated into our time machine. It wasn't perhaps what Terry was hoping for. So we did one in a much more grand and interesting space. And we also wanted to make it more interesting and more realistic, shall we say, and actually by the end of it, when all the lights were blinking and the thing was working, it almost seemed like it would work. It was, it was well lit, and I thought it was really kind of amazing
there was nothing better than coming in at like 6:30 in the morning when you're tired, and then you walk into that room and it's all lit up and you're like, oh, this is pretty cool for an office. Yeah. This is actually really cool. and it's different from, because we've all been on the spaceships and that sets, and those are amazing too, but there was something about that blue light that came out of that
yeah,
thing.
Totally. I think the whole thing worked well. Everybody really came together on those, on that set. So ask you about the concept. As I was flying up there, I was thinking, well, what, you know, this is underneath a power station, I think, or underneath some structure.
Yeah.
Can you guys? And initially, you know, and so it was like, what would that look like? Well, it'd have to be really massive. And so I came up with some ideas of these huge concrete. Everything was really concrete-y. And the initial idea was lots of circles. And then we went and found this real power station, which had those concrete kind of arches. And I thought, that's the look. And it turns out, of course, that's the Hearn Power Station in Toronto, which is shot in a lot of things. And we did use that for other parts of the show. But that sort of basic architectural vernacular, that language, was something that I really thought was very appropriate for us. So that's why it has those shapes in it. And also that giant high room, I love that. I love to get some space. We were fortunate enough to have a very big stage, and I wanted to use use it to the maximum. And it had some additional built-in levels that I wanted to incorporate into that set. So we ended up with that kind of power station-y, concrete-y vibe, which I thought actually worked really well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought it translated amazing. I came into the show, I think it was one episode in, John, or one or two episodes in, I took over. And when I walked in and saw the, the time machine room, the main galleria there, when I walked in, I thought I was like gobsmacked when I walked in there, because I saw this huge time machine, which I was like, what is this? Right. And then I saw the my naivete, I saw the walls and everything that had built. And I had just assumed that, you know, we were in a concrete facility, that's what the building was. I didn't really, know until like the next day. And I'm like, oh, that's all set. But John had built, like, John and the team had built this fantastic, amazing area for sure. It was great.
Yeah, they did a great job. And also the aging, that in my world, the making things look old or different is super important. So the team that does the painting is crucial. And they did a fantastic job to make that place look old. And and just the way, I wanted it, and I think Terry liked it. So that was definitely very important to have those colors and just the 50s vibe, and then the age, and just it's quite complicated. There are quite a lot of layers that people don't necessarily, it's all unspoken. Nobody really sits there and says, here, look at this tile and look at this, rust. But so it's all things you just take in and it feels believable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we've, there's, Could you all explain, you know, you obviously have sort of the circle, the blue ring of the time machine, but also for fans, the actual chair itself is rather iconic. Can you all explain where that chair came from?
Well, the chair is
that would
part
be a Terry
the,
question.
Yeah. So the chair was part of the original. So as John was saying, we shot the pilot over the course of 2-3 weeks in December of like 2012 or 2013. I forget what it was. Very cold in Detroit. And the time machine, we kept losing all of our sets. Like we wanted it, there was at one point, it was in the middle of an abandoned Detroit like auto factory. And like the rendering of it was, I mean, it was huge. And it's like, if we were going to shoot the series there, we would just occupy the space. But one by one, because everything was so dilapidated in Detroit, it was unsafe. So NBC Universal was like, there's no way you're bringing a crew there. You're going to all die. So we didn't do that. And eventually, you know, so Ruth Amon, our original production designer, really all she had was knew it was like a, kind of like a particle accelerator. And we knew he needed to get in a cool chair. And I think she found the chair at some airplane, you know, aerospace equipment thing. And so you can, in fact, I think you could see it on the in the deleted scene with Ramsey. On the, it's very different. The actual set itself, it had like kind of like a blue, it was like a tunnel kind of thing. And like John said, it was fine for making this series and showing the intention of what the space was, but it wasn't for showing like the pilot, but it wasn't right for to spend the whole time like series. And we had no space for Jones and the scientists and whatnot. So but we knew like the basic front end of the time machine worked. It just needed like a whole, like needed to be bigger, extended and jazzed up. And the chair, now the chair didn't have that like extended leg section either. It was just kind of part of the chair. So John got the front part of that time machine, which God, can't even believe they kept it somewhere, and the chair, and then had to do everything kind of around those ideas. But I don't think we ever really found out what plane it's an ejection seat from. I do know we looked long and hard for another one, and we never found
it. Yeah. Yeah. Boy, did we.
Cool item.
Yeah, to this day, some of my suppliers still call me up and send me photos saying, is this the chair? Because they'll trip up. And it's like, are you still looking for it? Is this it? And I'm like, no. And I said, but so if funny. It is it, that day when it is it, I'll call Terry and I'll say it's on you.
Yeah, I'm sure I'll probably buy it. But the I think the only time we ever found it was years later. It was on a website and then we called it. And then I think we found out that when we called them, they're like, oh, we sold it to some TV show for Universal Studios. I'm like, oh shit, that's ours. And they still had it. They still had it up on their site. But that's yeah, funny. So we don't know. It Sorry, is prominently ahead. Displayed right now up on a nice pedestal and display right now in my arcade at my house. So
that's fantastic. Nice. That's
you
so
guys
fantastic.
Need to come by and see it.
I think that whole thing and putting it on the kind of dais thing of the steps. And then I think we had a thing that raised it up and stuff really kind of iconified that whole thing. And then when he's in the, or he or she are in that light, it's quite a spectacular thing. I never really got tired of that.
But there's also the other section too, which I think is really important for the scientists, was we never really had a look. And I remember early on, John's like, so what do we do for them? And I'm like, well, it's kind of like the bridge, right? It's kind of like Star Trek. You got a helmsman and a navigator. And then, you know, you couldn't put Jones in a chair. And so I remember saying podium. I drew like a stick figure thing, what I thought it should be like. And I like took a picture of it and sent it to John. And then, you know, John goes and is like, all right, well, now I need to make the stick figure thing look good that this idiot drew.
You know, we're always happy to get the stick figures. It's not a problem. It's all good.
And there was a lot of that. But, you know, what was so great about John and Justin is if you have people who can elevate your vision, you've won the war. you know, because sometimes we'll just write, for instance, interior dark space, the pallid man tortures Jennifer Moyne or whatever it is, right? And so, and it's great for storytelling. And then, you know, it's up to these poor guys to be like, what's a dark space? What do you mean? Is it like a basement? It's like, and you're like, I don't know. It's like where they do stuff. And so, you know, they have to work with locations and be like, how do we make this thing kind of interesting? And you can get very lucky. And also, I've worked on other things. You can get unlucky, or you show up on the set that day and you're like, oh my God, I really should have been more specific about something. I'll say this again. I've said this on other podcasts, is we had no money. So mm-hmm. anything that these guys did came from pure creativity. And I think, you know, I've been talking about this at work recently right now, because I'm on a show with a significantly larger budget, but I really believe that those limitations can make you more creative and give you some more interesting results. Having said that, I still wish we had another $2 million an episode on 12 Monkeys, mm-hmm. but...
Mm-hmm. I do too, but I do agree that some of those restrictions do sort of force you to be perhaps more creative or really think more out of the box. And I think we were lucky on, both, you know, we had a great decoration team with Justin. We also had a good location team or teams. And mm-hmm. people were, I think, realized that we were trying to make a good show, trying to make a good looking show. I mean, not just Terry, but but more sort of boots on the ground. We want to make this thing look great. And I really felt that there was a sort of a fairly uniform feeling that let's make it look good. And I thought that was, I really enjoyed working in Toronto, I have to say.
So, yeah, me too.
It was, you know, there wasn't quite so much, we've seen it all before. This is just a cheap show, you know, which I've definitely seen, but, you know, and it wasn't that. And that was made a huge difference to people just going out a little. They'd look for a little longer. They'd look at different options. They'd go, oh, you know, I remember seeing that little place that, you know, what about that place? And, or you know, in Justin's case, you know, well, we could do a little more searching. What about that little guy that sells stuff out and the whatever? And just going that extra few yards. And I felt mm-hmm. that we really benefited from that.
Mm-hmm. Actually, John, that's really interesting, because I remember when we did the No Man's Land and
World War One trenches.
Not the trenches.
I was going to say, I can't remember the world.
It was the between the Berlin Wall.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Oh, right.
Remember when we went out there and did that? Yeah. And like, we were way out of the zone and out of Toronto and way out there on the road. And I remember thinking, you know, why are we, you know, where are we going? And, you know, why are we out here? And it's so far. And then when I got here, I was like, damn.
Yeah.
This really works. And so... Jonathan had laid out all these different ideas of these barricades, and, you know, we brought in all these burnt out cars, and, you know, we had all of these soldiers, and I you know, and that still resonates with me to this day, how great that set looked. And we had those spotlights searching and the barbed wire, and
I agree.
Yeah, it was a good day. Yeah.
There's not enough footage of it, actually. There's really not a wide shot that really takes in how big that space was too. Mm-hmm. Like
mm-hmm. it was big.
It was a feature set, basically.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And, that worked out pretty well. That's
I wish we had more footage of it.
Yeah, that was, I'm so glad you brought that up. Oliver Grigsby, for fans that are on the Facebook page, actually posted photos of you all building that set. And that's one of those moments as a fan where you realize how much you take for granted what you see on screen and what you all had to build just for one episode, you know, one trip to the 1960s. Yeah. We would love to hear about the Emerson Hotel. And how it in and of itself is telling, you know, it's always the backdrop and it's kind of this beloved home for the audience and the characters. It's like this touchstone, this place, no matter what decade you're in, that you come back to. But it also is, you know, it's telling the story of kind of these luxury hotels that were around in the 40s. And then we see sort of where it's ended up in the 90s or in our present day. Yeah. So, Terry, I don't know if you want to start off just what you all were, you know, writer's room, the idea for the hotel, and then John can pick up from there.
Yeah. I mean, the Emerson Hotel is an idea we should have had in season one, although when you watch it, the series in order now, it's kind of nice to discover it in season two as the mythology deepens. It really was that we didn't have a great idea for where Cole and Cassie would operate in season one. And all the old timey goodness that became the Emerson Hotel, we kind of tried to throw into. I was like, I don't remember where the bookstore came from. It was some idea that Travis and I had, and it was to give it a less polished look. We knew they couldn't just be hanging around Cassie's apartment. It just felt wrong. I remember there was like an early draft when I think Natalie wrote, and like that act, it was Cassie's apartment, and like Cole walked up to a treadmill and turned it on and fell off. And I was like, you know what? This is exactly the thing we can't do. So we were like, what else could we do that implied history and was moody? Like, that was the key. It had to be moody.
Right. I think we did end up making the bookstore, but as you said, it didn't work as well as we had hoped. Mm-hmm. Then you guys
I mean, it, like the light through the newspaper, and it really is.
No,
nice.
I didn't mean so much the look. I just think you were restricted, and it was too linear, too one thing.
Yeah, exactly. So the Emerson came out of, you know, one, we knew they were going to go further. Like season one, they didn't go very far. They were just mostly traveling in the present day. We knew they were going to go back in the 40s. And then it was just like, what if it's the time traveler hotel? And you could hide all these Easter eggs from adventures that are coming in that room and in that hotel. And it just was kind of perfect. And boy, did we use that set a lot. And it never really felt like it got old. And there was never, if you go back and watch the show, there's never a moment where you're like, oh, we're back in this set again, which can happen on TV shows. Like, I start to feel it. I'm like, oh, they just redressed this because they ran out of money. But for the Emerson, John built so much of it. There were hallways. We had another room. We had the lobby. We had the bar. And then there was a lounge in the lobby. Yeah. So we were able to just use so much of it. It was pretty fantastic. Then, so we built it, and then in season three, we moved it to a, didn't yep. we have to like pack it all up and then move it to a different soundstage?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah. Yeah. It was built twice.
Yeah, that was great. It was built twice.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So first of all, I think the idea was really a genius move, one of several really, really genius moves in the show. The other was that time is sentient. I thought that was one of the most interesting things of the show for me personally. But as a production design challenge or problem to solve, it was a great one. And you know, we researched the New York hotels, ones that were defunct, ones that, and they were, as you say, Gilded Age places that. And then they had fallen on hard times, and some had still remained. And you know, it's not based on any one hotel, but it has elements of several hotels. I did want to have a mezzanine, you know, with the stairs. I thought that was really important, and a way to look down upon the lobby rather than just a lobby. You know, the lobby was really important for it. You could have those, and then I wanted to have something in it. Like, I think initially it might have been a fountain, but it ended up being a clock, which I think was great because of the time. And then several different spaces that were discreet, so we didn't have to have all the people milling about all the time, like in the bar, and then sort of be then near the elevators, and then up top in the little mezzanine. So lots of different spaces for them to set scenes. The good thing about the room is that it really stays the same all the time. And I think so. Although we did make some small changes, obviously when the hotel gets overgrown, that was a great change and looked wonderful. The room does become kind of a constant, and I think that's a really important reason for why it doesn't seem old, because it's not being redressed and repolished and turned into something else. And I really because there is often pressure to recycle sets, that was definitely one that we really fought hard to keep hold of, so we didn't have to keep remaking it. And that was, I think, one of the reasons that was that it does feel like a touchstone. It feels very comfortable. It worked. I think that set worked really well. Also, the colors and the feel and the tone of it was great.
Yeah.
Do you all have one of the sets, at least as an audience member, when you see the Emerson Hotel overgrown as sort of this desolate but also beautiful, like abandoned garden? I'd love to hear a little bit about, right, because that's conveying, that's a big jump. You've taken us through a lot of different decades, but that is a jump that is, it really signals to the audience where in time we are, and to take something that's so familiar and really transform it.
Well, I can say, our transitions, certainly the room was great because we had, we had some sort of iconic elements in there that we would sort of ebb and flow. We'd put little sneaky little Easter eggs here and there in their suite. But I loved the lobby. And it's interesting when we started, Jonathan and I would, remember when we were sharing pictures back and forth about like found apartments in Paris that had been locked up and, exactly. It had been left at like these little time capsules. And
yes.
John would be like this. And I'm like, yeah, this is amazing. And so we would try to, we would try to bring that to the floor. And, and then when John was looking at all of these awesome lobbies and I won't say The Shining, but I'll just say all of these, this majesticness. When John brought in these curved staircases and we were looking at the wallpapers and what the challenge was to transform that environment so many different times. So we were doing the 60s and the 70s and when we had the overgrown element and we tried to gently destroy as much of the lobby as possible, because next week we would have to bounce it back to, back to present day. Right. So that was always like, okay, make it look really bad, but Wednesday it's got to be back to ones again. And it's like, oh God.
Yeah. That's definitely one of the challenges of television is that, you do have to recycle sets and especially with the time travel show, you could be back in its heyday in the next episode.
and here's a key point that I don't know if a lot of people talk about, but as us that sort of run the show and we're sort of manufacturing these elements, like what my challenge was, and John's and graphics and everything, like, three episodes down the line, we might need back to that same space and have it look exactly the same. So, or we might have to go, back to the room or back to here. So we had to track all of these elements and all of these graphics. So it's not as if we could, say recycle something and then, okay, we're done with the set, moving on. We would actually have to save all of these elements and track them. So like, for example, in the temporal facility, John, if you want to talk about the boards, with the papers,
the boards.
With all the newspaper articles, the boards, right? Like if there was a wrinkle in time, that post-it note needed to be 10 inches to the right. Right. And yeah. So tracking all of that was a Herculean effort, I'd forgotten about the boards.
Yeah, that's, yeah. You're absolutely right. So the boards was a solution to a displaying of information problem that we had, that we didn't want it all to be digital. And we wanted to be able to change it and play with it and have it more tactile. And so that's how that sort of ended up being what it was, and having different layers and having the boards be on wheels so they could be pushed around and cover, certain things could be covered up and certain things could be exposed at will. And so it was a very useful tool, and I think we used it quite a lot. We also did have digital displays, older style, but keeping track of, I think I had one person who was just doing that. That was all they did, was take photographs and take notes. And make
sure
everything.
Well, there were multiple boards too at one point, right? Like you could take down the future board and then put up the old boards. And I've said this before, I on the very last day of shooting, I was directing, and the last shot, I think, was Cassie on the balcony of Titan, which we're that balcony was also on the same sound stage as our facility, or the main facility. And I was kind of dreading the goodbye, even though we weren't finished shooting the series because we would go to Prague for another 2 months or so. I was sad to see this goodbye. And I said to Amanda, I'm like, you know, we're going to call wrap, and then I'm going to walk into that time machine room and I'm just going to break down. I'm just going to cry looking at that time machine again. And so in fact, every break I would go and I'd look at the time machine and kind of say goodbye to it. So what we called wrap, and Amanda and I were walking around and saying goodbye, and she's in tears. And we got to the time machine. I'm like, oh yeah. And I'm like, oh, we got to say goodbye to the evidence board. And when I saw the evidence board, that's when, because it was the whole story of the whole series, like 4 years of push pinning up each one of these plot ideas, from like Leland Frost to the story to Titan to the prime to the messengers, all the, like. And so that was unexpectedly the when I got the most emotional was saying goodbye to those boards.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. That was a cool looking set, though, I must say. That whole vibe was great. And you guys were so clever in creating all those different connections. It was very impressive.
One of we'd love to hear about, and maybe Terry, you can start us off, one of, for lack of a better word, coolest, most original sets, even ideas of the show is Titan, a time traveling city. So,
Oh my God, we have so many stories about this.
No, so Terry, if you want to, you know, it comes up in the writer's room, it's a time traveling city. What does that look like? How does it work?
So, from right after season one, we knew this, that this place existed, this, where the witness was operating from. And we always knew, I think Travis called it Titan first, I think. And there were many discussions. We knew that season two was going to be the journey to find this place, to go, you know, into the lion's den. And I think it was Chris Monfette who was like, what if there's a giant ring around the city and you cross it? And what you don't know is the whole thing is it's a time machine. And I remember was like, how? That's crazy. And then a couple few days went by. I'm like, actually, that's pretty cool. Cause then imagine looking for a place, and you know, it's where it's supposed to be. And you've got its longitude and latitude. And when you get there, it's not there. And the reason it's not there is it's not there yet, but it might be there tomorrow. And so it started to evolve. And then it was like, well, how do you move a city like this? The foundation must go with it, right? Which is why those craters are left behind, because you can't just drop a city on top of any kind of landscape without having major issues. So I'm always fascinated whenever I'm on a road and I see those oil refineries and there's just lights everywhere and it looks so infinitely complicated. That was like, well, it would make sense that a refinery and a power station would be its base just for the intricate complications. But like, what if there are these towers? And if you can't see it, but if you went up there, you're like, oh, those are Jones's time machines. And there's a ton of them and they connect and they make a big kind of anime sort of symbol and the whole thing, you know. It was just, I don't know, it was crazy kid imagination. But we had nothing like that to shoot in. Like, and the whole conclusion of season two was walking inside a giant time machine. So, John, I'm going to hand this over to you as to how locations found this and how we turned it into. And then what we did for season three when we knew we were going to be like, because we were able to find out location in season two, but season three, we had to be there all the time. And so that required another thing. So take it away.
Cool. So I have to be honest, I'm sort of not quite sure exactly when some of these sets played into which seasons, but we did use the power station, the Hearn power station, for the corridor with the repeating red arches, and we did
build that's season three, right?
Okay.
Yeah.
And season three, was that when we went to Sarnia to the
season two? The end of season two was Sarnia. That was the big, like...
Well, that was a defunct oil refinery, quite a long way from where we were living, where we were working. And they were generally, we were fortunate enough to, for the location department. This is another example. You know, we said, where could we do this? And they said, well, there is this place, but it's miles away. And it was a long way away. So we had to go and look at it and figure out how to do it at night. So it added more to the look and add a whole bunch of, Justin made a whole bunch of lights and all sorts of, we painted things on things and we made the giant dais. And then we basically kind of lit it and shot it in a, and I think we also made some structures, the structure where they run across mm-hmm. the edge. And mm-hmm. So it was using a non-working but still completely extant refinery or small refinery and adding, it did have these great towers that Terry and I thought were just awesome. When we remember the first day we went there,
it was just
fantastic. We thought, man, we could totally see that.
So just to also jump in, it's you can't shoot in an oil refinery. Like it's so dangerous. And then we had to go out there. Everyone had to be we all had steel tip boots, right? We all had to be in jumpsuits.
Full personal protection equipment. We all had to wear these special coveralls, hard hats, glasses, gloves,
yes, that's right.
And then steel toe boots, which is kind of a normal thing anyway in our industry. However, there was this, and because the oil refinery was being abated, they're like, okay, so don't wander off. This is the area you need to be in. Don't go snooping around. And if you hear this alarm, this siren, run to this room. It's a blast-proof safety room. And we're like, what? We're like, what? Yeah. So we're
go
like,
back.
This is,
say that again.
This is where, this is the, we call them like gathering points, but he goes, you need to get in here as quickly as possible. And as we go in, we see like the 6-inch thick glass and, you know, the steel door and, you know, and all of this stuff, right? We're like, where are we shooting here? Like what's happening, right? But anyway, it wasn't that bad. That was just for the survey. When we ended up actually working there, things got a little bit more relaxed, but it was very interesting.
It was a fantastic look for our show, particularly we could never have afforded to build that. There was just so much scope that, and I'd forgotten about the safety precautions, but Justin's absolutely right. That's exactly what happened.
We went there for end of season two, and then we went back for the big finale. We went and where they had opened up even a larger space for us. For the corridor look, the red corridor, we knew that would be sort of in the belly of Titan, right? But we didn't because Sarnia was 2.5 hours away from we couldn't go there, and we wanted to spend a lot of time in Titan. So we just went to our Hearn power station, which was also a temporal facility, and it made sense to us that the corridors would have those similar angles that were in the temporal facilities, because it was, you know, the same design. It was Elliot Jones who designed Titan, also designed the temporal facility, so there would be those touchstones. And I remember, when we wanted to go there, there was a lot of internal debate about what we would be able to light in that space and what we wouldn't. And John and I, and I was hell bent on doing it. And specifically, I don't know if you guys remember, it was the top of season three when we built the dais. In the center of that space, mm-hmm. and then you could go up three or four stories where Cassie jumps. Mm-hmm. That's all. There's no wizardry there. There's no like special effects. Cassie is literally up 200 feet or so on Amanda was on this safety rig. Camera crews were all up there. What you saw is what you got. Mm-hmm. That was
awesome.
And so, and I remember I was going to, there was a lot of pressure from producers and DPs who were like, we can't do this. And I was going to give up. And I looked over at John and he's like, go with your gut. this is going to be amazing. And
yeah,
it was you, John. I was like, okay, yes, we're doing it.
Remember that conversation.
And yeah. I think our producer at the time wanted to kill all of us because it was going to be an insane Herculean effort to pull it off. But we did.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was, yeah. I remember that one. And after that, when it was ready and we looked down and was like, glad we went with that, you know,
as
you,
oh, yeah, you,
all the lights were on and everybody was there and we were ready to start rolling. It's like, man, this is cool.
Yeah.
It's, and that, that's such a beautiful shot. Yeah. Well, I'm glad you guys went with your gut. There are a few, you know, in seasons 3 and 4 sets that are within Titan, whether it's Cassie's chamber that almost seems like a renaissance, prison. So I'd love to hear about that, as well as in season 4, building how the witness taps into with all of those, you know, hoses, you know,
Olivia's chamber.
Yeah, cool. Terry, do you want to lead off on that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, it's all just geeky imagination. For Cassie's chamber, when it was very, I mean, they're all, the 12 monkeys are very dramatic. They take their religion very seriously. I remember at one point we were on set and there's a couple of acolytes, those guys in the red masks. The guys had their masks on, the extras, and they were talking. And one turned to the other and was like, so why do you think we joined this cult? And the other one goes, oh, you know, religious satisfaction, you know, a real path in life. And they were like working it out, but like kind of like, it was like,
that's, if awesome,
you could hang out with the 12 monkeys on their breaks, but they're very dramatic. And so, you know, for the mother of their deity, the witness, they would treat with, you know, the utmost respect. You wanted to change, like, have a really surprising, also, you, if you can travel anywhere in history, you can get in all the furniture you want, you know, you can get wherever. So that was kind of stained glass windows. And it was just, you know, it was also foretelling where we were going to go in season 4 with the Middle Ages a bit. And then the other room that you're talking about with that Olivia's chamber, which is kind of her throne room, which we actually did render with a chair sitting up on that dais at one point. It felt too familiar for her to be sitting in a throne. I liked how she would sit in the center of her cell in season 2 in a sort of calm Zen pose. And I was like, how cool would it be if that's how you found the witness, you know, dressed up with that mask and whatnot. And so the idea that she tries to become primary, this ability to tap into time by hooking into Titan. I mean, that's just, you know, that's just all my anime, geek, Matrix, Ghost in the Shell.
Ghost in the Shell is what I was riffing on for sure.
Yeah, for sure. You had to remember, we talked about that. And then we had to hook that all into a suit that was already pre-made. And then I would walk in and be like, more wires. I mean, need more wires. And then the DPs would yell at me. They're like, we have wires. We can't see the lights. I'm like, I don't care. But that was actually, Olivia's chamber was a redress of the museum-y round set in season 3, where you walk in and the mask was on display. I don't know if you remember that, and all the pieces of the witness's life are all in a circle there. That's actually the same bones.
Yeah. So basically if you didn't have money, how could you make it cool?
Right.
We did make some fairly large changes. Not large changes to the actual set, but we added all that stuff in the roof. And of course the ideas of her being connected and then the dais she's on. So, you know, also I kind of like that sort of multi-sided room. We did that in Cassie's chamber as well. And we did want something that was not so gritty as everything else or so dark. It was a pretty place. And as Terry was saying, you know, if you had the mother of the witness, you'd want to, even though she's in prison, it'd be a pretty nice prison. And, you know, be pretty, a lot of softness. And I did think, you know, going back in time, back to more ornate eras was really appropriate for the furniture and the bed and the chairs and all that kind of stuff. So it really added a whole different look what was, you know, a futuristic world, but yet they, you know, they were harking back to the past, which I thought was really interesting from that set. So they were similar in sort of style physically, but they had a very different look to how they were finally realized.
We'd love to hear about one of, in terms of a place that the audience goes on a really interesting journey, is the House of Cedar and Pine. And it begins as a mantra, as an idea in season one, and sort of a trippy vision, which Terry, you've talked to us in the past sort of about how that came about. But then it goes, you know, the audience goes on a journey where it's a place where a cult talks to their god. It's a place that represents another sort of prison for Cassie. It becomes a home. It's a place that's destroyed. And then it's the final image of the series where you feel like you sort of exhale and you're home again. And so much of that is what you all created. And so we'd love to hear sort of about how you brought that House of Cedar and Pine from just a line of dialogue and made many different places that had very different feels depending on where we were in the story.
Yeah, I mean, that's where I would say, like, John and Justin and Sean Tretta and Chris Byrne, who is our second unit director. It's kind of was like we were a bunch of jazz musicians, you know, mm-hmm. and one of us says, you know, in a thing, it's a house of cedar and pine, you know, and the drummer's going, yeah, well, that's cool, right? Yeah, and it's out in the middle of nowhere, yeah, right? And then someone comes up with a little trumpet, it's Chris Byrne, and he goes and he finds this unbelievably iconic thing that, like, it was as if it was made for 12 Monkeys,
sure.
On location, and then we're taking pictures, and then we like, what's it look like on the inside? So that was kind of the extraordinary that's a representation of how well we all got along creatively, is each iteration of that idea inspired the others to make, you know, to find the right wallpaper, the furniture, you know, it was one of those things.
Yeah, John, totally. Justin, what do you totally guys? Agree with that. Well, I mean, first of all, just the ideas of, you know, one there's another example of how creative, you know, Terry and his writers were in coming up with all these different ways of doing things in this house, if you like. You know, the wallpaper, having the writing on it, and then and setting different things in it when it gets all shot up. So a lot of it was how do we make those things that are written down happen, and then maybe how can we add to the mix, you know, add a bit of spice to the story and make some suggestions about the look and the feel. You know, I did think the location was perfect, you know, a house in the middle of nowhere. It was just a perfect place. And we were at one point it was going to get demolished, and we said, no, don't demolish the house.
That's so right. Yeah.
We had to keep hold of the house. And then, you know, what might it look like? I don't think we ever shot inside the house. So we created.
No, we weren't allowed because it was such a health and safety issue. But we almost burned it down. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do.
for the actual fire that happens at the end of season three, they were going to let us burn it down, we really went there. But the issue was, if you burn it down, you're then responsible for removing the debris, and some of the debris would be toxic or something. Mm-hmm. There was something that was like, no.
But no. That was the big no.
Well, I know this. I can remember who said no to that.
Yeah, I remember who said no too.
But yeah, Dr. No, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and wisely so. I mean, visual effects wise, they burned it down, and honestly, they did such a good job, you couldn't tell.
We had some real flames, though. We didn't burn it down, but we did have real flames on that house. I'm sure we did.
We went upstairs. Yeah. I know, in the windows, and I think we were able to get inside in hazmat suits.
But we didn't actually burn it down. But it looked like it was burning down.
I remember when we went on the survey and we went there. I was like, "This is an incredible building." You know, what's inside? And they're like, "Oh, there's flies." And I was like, well, what do you mean flies? And they're like, oh, there's like so many flies in there. And I'm like, well, how many flies could be in there? Right. So we actually, you know, we went in and we were like ankle deep in flies. Like of yeah. like trillions.
It's a really
trillions.
Horrible interior.
trillions of flies.
Things
and I'm
died
like, why are there so many? Why are there so many flies in this house? Every floor, every staircase, every room. It was horrifying.
Well, that means they're eating something.
Yes,
something like they don't just hang, flies have a very short life like span, so something's keeping them alive in there, and I don't want to know what.
This is the part of the story you really don't want to hear about how you make these TV shows.
Right. But I mean, but every time, like every time you drove to this location, because it's farmland, and then in the middle is this. It's a large structure, I suppose, a large house. It's just so iconic looking. Like, you can't not be like, whoa, what's that about? Like, is that a haunted house in the middle of nowhere? And I love that fans have taken the pilgrimage and they post pictures of themselves in front of the house.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Imagine if you had burned it down. We couldn't do that.
Yeah. But yeah, there's a but every once in a while I'll pop up like I did it. I found the house and it's still a spray painted thing. I mean, if I could afford it, I'd buy it. But then I'd still have to tear it down and rebuild it because there's nothing you can use.
Yeah.
But it's really cool looking. And I think it's a tough thing, right? Because it also has to first. It's this creepy old house that's in these visions. Then there's a moment where they live there where you kind of warm up to the creepy haunted house that's supposed to represent dread. And so this is why these guys are geniuses. They had to, we had to build the interior on our sets. And so they've got to go. I mean, John found this, or maybe it was Justin found this really old wallpaper, you know, that was actual period wallpaper. And then we had to reconstruct that. And then this is also, they come up with a backstory too for things that I hadn't taken into account. For instance, like what was it when Cole bought the house, you know? And I remember coming on set and it was like an old hunting cabin. There was like shotguns and like, you know, it was very, very cabiny. And I was like, I didn't think about that, but that's, you know, why this is a representation of when you have geniuses like these gentlemen, they come up and help you tell those stories.
It's always lovely to be called a genius, so I'll take that. But
that's very kind.
But I think it is true that we did come up with backstories. We said at one point it would have been just a normal house and with a normal family. And so I don't remember if we had that wallpaper printed or if Justin, if you found it, but we did talk about what kind of wallpaper it would be what kind of time frame it would have come from. So it would have been not an unusual house at that time, but it was many, many years later. And then it had been taken over perhaps by some older guy with we talked about the hunting and those things. Those stories, that unspoken stuff is really important to what we do. You know, it's not necessary. Sometimes it's in the script. It's still unspoken, but we are kind of told, it's encouraged or we're given a direction. But sometimes it isn't, and we kind of have to come up with it. And that adds to the texture of the show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you tell the story about, you know, they're living there. What are they doing? You know, how are they spending their time? You know, what is life in a beautiful, you know, farmhouse and, you know, the idyllic setting. That was a fun set to dress.
Mm. Yeah. I thought that did, and it did go through all these different iterations and it was very warm and loving when they're in there. And that was important that it was lit that way. And we had nice lighting and we had picked that. I think we got some slightly nicer furniture. We made it seem someplace that you would want to be.
Right.
I know that we're getting short on time, but there are two other worlds that we wanted to ask you all about just because they were such, at least for the audience, leaps in time. The first is fans have seen some drawings of building the primary time machine around an existing church. I think fans got to hear Sean Tretta explain how you found a church that was no longer in use. But how did you all go about designing something that would be both familiar to the audience in terms of the time machine, but also built hundreds of years in the past.
Well, this is a case of how to drive your department head crazy, because John, we had concept art done by an art, because we didn't even know. Where it was like, what does a medieval time machine look like? You know, if it's powered by a paradox and a thing, you know, like it should be reminiscent of our machine in Toronto, but be gothic and cool and made of gears and things. I think we, John, jump in it, because you lived and breathed this in Prague, and it was literally down to the wire. I think like you guys had just put the last bit of things on it like minutes before.
Yes, we were still working, I think, that night and certainly that morning.
This is in Prague. We shot this, by the way.
Loved the idea of it being in a church. That was definitely from the writers. We did find some really cool churches. But we did find, to actually put the time machine in, we found a deconsecrated church, quite a fair bit out of Prague, which had a great vibe. And then for the time machine, we came up with a number of different ideas based on sort of gothic versions of our machine, you know, with the chair and the stairs up and we couldn't afford to make the gears and stuff. There wasn't enough money, but we had these windows where we had hoped that we could see gears inside it, but I think they ended up just being windows, but they were still cool. So there was something inside this thing. But in fact, it ended up, we only really built small portions of it. I mean, we built the whole front. So if you stood in front of it, it absolutely looked real. If you got too far off one side, you start to see the cracks. But where they fight and where we see it and walking up to the stairs. And then of course there's the lighted side. It really felt very, very realistic. And we tried to make it seem something that could have been built inside this church at a very long time ago.
And then the gears were added in like CGI when it turned.
Did you add gears? I can't remember.
Yeah. When it starts to move, when it all lights up, but one of the other reasons it was kind of a miracle we found that church, because we did look at other cathedrals, and they would, and so you'd have to submit your script to the Catholic Church, and then they'd all get to the part, and then she takes a sword and cuts off Deacon's head, and they're all go,
"What?" Right, that's really right. I forgot that.
We don't want that in our church. And then it's like, then you have to go through it like, well, I mean, do we shoot that as a special insert somewhere else? Like, how do we get away with this? But we really needed to kind of own the space.
We did.
The other thing is, you can't see, you know, the final version is all clear, but the roof had a net on it, like, because it was a stone. This old church was a very old stone church that would have been abandoned. But we had to put a net in because blocks of the ceiling would come down and potentially kill you. So there was this net above it.
It was wild. Yeah.
See, Justin, while you were moving on to in a comfortable space to the expanse, the air conditioned, and we were nearly killing ourselves.
Prague was a fabulous place to shoot with all the different for the historical aspects, and we got so much mileage out of going to Prague with the different eras, and so it was a wonderful opportunity, and also it really worked creatively. The church was just one of many places we went, although probably the biggest thing we built, and we also had to add a lot of leaves and tons of vines, and we did really have to own that place. So all our ideas of doing a real church, it wouldn't have been as good looking if we hadn't had that.
No,
church.
Yeah, exactly.
As you all are describing that, and then what's staggering is the next question is, you also did a Western. How did you pull that off in the same season?
By the skin of our teeth. Well, the Western was really tough because at least initially, our producer was like, we can't afford to do this, to do a Western. And I was like, but how? Imagine we're going to do it anyway. How would we do it? And we found, and boy, this is right. But say I was going to ignore you. Justin and John really came to play on this one, because I don't even want, you should explain what we found, the town, that little like space that somebody built.
Yeah. Well, there that? Was a,
that wasn't me. Was it, John? I don't think that was me on that one.
I don't,
were you gone?
I don't remember. Maybe
I was gone about the fourth episode in there,
but we still remembered you.
Oh
though.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
Yes. In a very positive way.
Yes.
The town was really not a town. It was just a few buildings tacked together. And the way we were very fortunate enough to, you know, with the DPs and ourselves working together, is make it look more than it was. It was had been made for a movie maybe or something, but we did have to do quite a lot of work to make
it. No, you're forgetting. The guy just built it for himself.
Oh, for himself?
Yeah, it was the side of a freeway. Like, that's if right. You would turn the camera around, there was like a McDonald's but there was this big long stretch, and it was painted like primary colors.
Yeah,
it was like blue and pink. The saloon was pink, and so we came in. John came in like, "Look, will you let us repaint it and make it look real?" And then I believe. Stop me if I'm wrong or if you haven't heard this, like he once it was done and we shot there, he's like, I'm gonna keep it this way.
I think,
and so
it's true.
it still looks that way.
I mean, it looks so much better when we left. Yeah. So but we were fortunate to have it was sort of like a one side of a street and maybe a little corner. And also they did have that little saloon which didn't required some extra work, but we were very fortunate to find even that because we had so little money we couldn't have built all those facades, so we were very fortunate that was available. And I think with the shooting of that and also the tent city, we did have to put all the tents up and figure out a way to make that seem like there was way more tents than there were. And then we were helped with visual effects with that. That was always an idea that we would do that for those shots where you look down, you see a much bigger tent city. That worked, I think, quite well, although touch and go on that one, I think. But that was definitely skin of the teeth, that one.
Yes. The whole show, skin of our teeth.
There are a couple instances in the show, whether it's in season two, Tommy Crawford's drawings of sort of an initial red forest and the red monkey on the wall, or Jennifer's drawings then becoming the Ouroboros on the floor that closes season three, a sketch of Eliza's tomb, and then you build that set, or the yellow spiral code on the walls when Jennifer finally paints the world. Can you walk us through... A lot of times it was something that the audience initially saw as just a sketch, and then, you know, it manifests itself as a set. Are there any stories from any of those examples you all could walk us through of how you created that?
Well, I think what we tried to do was find the location first, or at least a sense of what it would be. You know, the statue is something you could sketch at any point, and then... you know, put the statue anywhere. I think the tougher one would be, we were shooting in Toronto. So in season three, remember there was the gala that Cole and Cassie go to, the masquerade. Mm-hmm. And there's a footsteps in the snow piece that needed to be, that Jennifer was drawing before we shot in Prague. So we would have to, John would go to Prague with David Grossman and Tretta, and they would take pictures like, we're going to use this. So we need to quickly draw that sketch back in Toronto. So that would all match up. Or worst case scenario, you could do a second unit later. That was not possible in season four because the last things we would shoot were in Prague. We would wrap the entire series in Prague. So we just had to get ahead of it in clever ways. But I think John,
there was an awful lot of art created, so we had different people doing a lot of these different sketches. Several different artists came in and did those sketches from, you know, and these are all things that came from the writers, from Terry and the writers, in terms of what the idea might be, and we would present different ideas as in terms of the vibe that we had for the show, or the vibe that they might want to go with, in terms of, you know, if these fragments are, you know, like the yellow pieces were fragments, and the art side was really quite comprehensive and quite time consuming and took a lot of quite a lot of resources to make that kind of stuff happen, particularly that set, which is completely covered in little fragments of yellow drawing. That was really kind of a big, I mean, it was great. It looked great, but that really took a lot of time. But we also, I just remembered as you were talking, Terry, that we actually made that sculpture of that. I had a sculptor sculpt that.
Oh yeah. Eliza,
that person.
Yeah.
In Prague, I'd forgotten that until you mentioned it. And some really great guy who was, you know, like in a little tiny sort of garret, and we had her pose, and he made it happen. And, you know, we made some changes and made it the right height, and we actually had that sculpture made. So rest, I think, you know, that sort of stuff is just great, you know, because that person was sculpted for that set.
And correct me if I'm wrong, that's something you can do in Prague, but a lot more difficult to do in Toronto.
Oh, yes. My reason for that is that in Toronto or the States, that would be a very expensive thing. That would probably be half the budget we had of that show. Oh, that for the art department of that show. I mean, really a lot of money. So, but in Prague, it was something we could afford to do.
Yeah.
It's incredible. Well, John and Justin, do you all have any, looking back on it, a favorite set that you built or challenge you look back on where you're like, oh, that was hard. But when you know, cameras rolled, you're like, that just looks really good.
From my point, I think I would say, you know, I love the temporal facility and I loved how the temporal facility kept growing. And we got an opportunity to build, you know, so many different looks, so many different spaces. You know, I was really proud of a lot of the work we did there. And then the Emerson, I still look back to the Emerson lobby and how many different times, you know, we changed it. And John and I are like, you know, what are we going to do here? And how are we going to riff on this? And, you know, what are the furnishings and the window treatments and the graphics? And so I would say the Emerson, sort of resonates with me the most.
Yeah, cool. I agree with Justin that I think the whole show for me has a really warm feeling about my involvement with it. I did think that the temporal facility is a very spectacular set, and I think it's probably, in looking back, it's one of my favorite sets from any job I've worked on. You know, when you come into that room, it's kick-ass, and that's very cool. I also really enjoyed the other time machine, the one in Prague. I enjoyed the time in Prague enormously. It really felt very collegiate and really felt like we were all working together. Not that we weren't in Toronto. It was just a smaller team and you know, you were in a different country. So it was, I really, really enjoyed that aspect.
Yeah.
Terry, how about you? Because, you know, for a lot of these, it was an idea in your head and then you walk on set. Any moment?
Yeah, I mean, it's the temporal facility. I mean, like for me, it's where everything came together. With, you know, walking into the time machine room, to Jones's podium, which I still have, to the furniture, to like Jones's chair, which I also still have, to the lights, you know, the really cool. I was just emailing Justin about it. I'm sure these guys are like, God, he really needs to let it go. But I absolutely love the hanging lights with the cages on the temporal facility.
Oh, the
pendant lights.
Yeah.
Just, those are fantastic. Mm-hmm. I watch a lot of science fiction, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of looks I think we did that still feel fresh and original. Like I don't feel like we were terribly derivative in anything that we did. And that's because of these gentlemen here.
There are some shows now where I kind of cock my head and be like, huh, that looks like 12 Monkeys.
We have been plagiarized a few times.
Yeah.
There is one very famous show that at first I was like, oh, you know, it's a coincidence.
And then that's right.
As the imagery went on, I was like, okay, that is not a coincidence anymore. Mathematically, that is somebody like, yeah. Anyway.
It's a compliment, I suppose.
Yes.
Highest form of flattery, right?
John and Justin, can you just, as closing out, where can audiences see your work next?
I did the last thing I did of real consequence was FBI. So it's a CBS show.
I would be on The Expanse. So season 5 on The Expanse. So that's where my last work is that you can see right now.
Got it. Nice. And that's coming out next month, right? Season 5?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're getting launched. Hopefully with some fanfare, but yeah, we'll be able to stream shortly.
Well, we will be watching. So that's
thank
exciting.
Thank you.
Absolutely. All right. Well, thank you all so much for taking this time. This is, you know, the sets you all designed, they are iconic to fans. You know, people drive out to go see the House of Cedar and Pine and, you know, make fan art of the time machine and the chair. So it
and the endures. Hearn, they go out to the Hearn too, guys.
They're great.
Of the temporal facility.
That's great.
Yeah.
Harry, I think you need to set up a museum with all your props.
kind of my the stairwell leading to my basement is all memories.
Next up, a conversation about directing with Terry Metalis and director and producer David Grossman, director of 16 12 Monkeys episodes. Thank you for listening, and until next time, we'll see you soon.